Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The earliest Christians found themselves, this goes nicely with our conversation just a moment ago with Craig Parton, they found themselves on a landscape that required rather bold witness. Now, we see from the book of Acts that these earliest Christians, the apostles first, and then as the church spread out, so did the proclamation of Christ and Him crucified spread out. We find these Christians being witnesses, just as Jesus had told them they would be. He said things to them like, "It is necessary that the Christ should suffer and die and rise again. You are witnesses of these things." With His appearance to His disciples and to the many, with His appearance to them, resurrected from the dead, He made them witnesses of the resurrection. St. Paul is bold to say that he himself was a witness of the resurrection, that he had seen Christ raised from the dead, and that he was proclaiming this very crucified and risen Christ to a world that needed this witness. I think that's what we often forget about these early Christians. They weren't simply out there in society trying to make a point. They were there not only being the very thing that Christ had made them, but they were there because the church needed to hear this witnessing word of the risen Christ. Joining us to talk about those early Christians and confessing Christ, Dr. James Buscher. He is Assistant Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of an article in the latest issue of For the Life of the World magazine titled, "You Are Witnesses Confessing Christ Crucified with the Early Christians." Dr. Buscher, welcome to Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Paint a picture of the world that the earliest Christians found themselves in when they were called to be, not just to make a witness, but to be witnesses.
Well, I think you have to recognize, you know, in the first few centuries of the church is a pre-Constantinian world, which, you know, basically means that the world is fundamentally pagan. Christianity is a very small minority, probably the Roman Empire certainly not really taking note of the Christian church much until the second century. In the second century, it probably becomes enough of a minority that the Roman government has to begin to take notice of it. But basically, you know, the world is pagan. The city cults are determinative of what life is like in the ancient world. Each city has its pagan cult that is at the heart of it. And the pagan cults were, you know, kind of like being patriotic, you know, in our own kind of thinking. I mean, they went to the pagan cults in the same way that we might say the Pledge of Allegiance or stand for the flag or something like that. It was your duty to patronize the cults, to offer sacrifices occasionally, to do your duty for the empire. It was, in a way, like paying your taxes, even. So it was just, in other words, just essential to life in the ancient world are the pagan cults, is this pagan identity. I guess the hardest maybe thing for us to kind of wrap our minds around is that there is no separation of church and state, no such thing as secularism in the ancient world. Therefore, no kind of notion of the state being neutral toward religion or toward spiritual things. Everything that takes place is inherently spiritual, is interpreted that way. Therefore, you know, something like Christianity that begins to come onto the scene becomes a definite problem for the Roman Empire in the sense that it enters directly into conflict with these city cults. It claims an exclusiveness to Christ, that there is only one God, and thereby basically says that all of these civic cults are fundamentally demonic, you know, from the Christian point of view. And it is, you know, precisely there that you're going to have a kind of profound conflict that's going to arise. On the one hand, Rome being rather tolerant and in wanting there to be, you know, of course, many gods and many religions and you know, this kind of perspective versus Christianity, which is very exclusive, that there is one city of God, that is the church, and that God relates to the world precisely through Jesus, who, in a sense, is the only true emperor in that kind of way. They certainly did see Christ that way, as a king and an emperor. So, you know, that creates a very visceral kind of conflict in the ancient world.
You point out, you put a fine point on this, we're talking about eyewitnesses here, that first generation of
right.
Christians, and that it was not only, they were not only to be witnesses of what they heard, but what they had seen and heard.
Right. Yeah, it's, and I think you can see that inherently in the Gospels themselves. And certainly early Christians made, you know, a great note of that throughout the early centuries, that the fact that God had now entered in an utterly new relationship to humanity. And this, in a little bit, was in contrast to the Jewish kind of notion as well, and certainly in kind of a development of the Old Testament, that now in Christ God had become flesh, which meant fundamentally that he had become visible. He could be seen. He could be embraced in the flesh. You know, John 1:14 is the easiest maybe place to see this, that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld, you know, we saw his glory. You know, Jesus in John 14, the same kind of thing. You know, when Philip says, "Show us the Father," he says, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." You know, in Luke, you get the same kind of thing. I always think it's significant, for instance, that the shepherds at in Luke chapter 2, they're not content simply to hear the angelic message that Jesus has been born. They hear that, but then immediately their desire is to let us go and see this thing that has taken place. And it's really only at the manger where they gather around this Son of God in the flesh that they then worship, and that worship takes place. And you can think of other examples. Simeon, "My eyes have seen your salvation," certainly building up to Luke 24 and the Emmaus disciples who finally their eyes are opened in the breaking of the bread. So, yes, seeing kind of has that connotation of an experience with this God in the flesh, not just hearing him from a distance, you know, something like that, which is how they kind of conceive the Old Testament, even the beginning of Hebrews, where it says God spoke to us in many and various ways through the prophets. As while that speaking was gracious and intimate, yet they kind of always wanted more. The Israelite always wanted to finally behold God. You can see that even in Moses, who desires to see God, you know, "Show me your face," or "Show me your glory," as Moses kind of says. And so this desire to see is always kind of there in the Old Testament that is fulfilled in the New, and the Christians certainly emphasize that point very strongly, that we testify to, and certainly the apostles, we testify to that which we have seen and heard, and that experience was important to them.
How would the pagan world have heard a message delivered by men who said, not only have we seen him raised from the dead, but this man is God in the flesh, the incarnation in particular? How would that have sounded to the pagan world?
Well, I think, excuse me, I guess in maybe there's a couple aspects to it. I mean, it's an interesting question. I think on the one hand, it would sound like true foolishness. For, you know, in the ancient world, they maybe had, you know, they certainly had a sense of the spiritual manifesting itself in physical ways. You know, certainly natural things, not natural phenomena that happen, you know, whether it's an earthquake or something like that. There was an inherent consciousness that this, everything was spiritual. Man himself is fundamentally spiritual in nature, and therefore cannot be reduced simply to the flesh or to the passions of the flesh or something like that. But the way the Greeks might put it, or even the ancient Romans, you are to live by reason. Reason is to kind of triumph over your flesh and that kind of thing. So there was a kind of natural affinity to something like it. I mean, it wouldn't be maybe as strange as it maybe sounds to us, in the sense that for us, when we hear about a kind of supernatural event or the idea of the incarnation or the resurrection, a lot of times it's objected to on a scientific basis, right? A kind of scientific materialism that basically outlaws any kind of supernatural, spiritual thing from taking place at all. And that's kind of our experience. In the ancient world, you would not have maybe that kind of hurdle to jump in that kind of sense. Certainly, if you had witnesses, that could be, you know, people would have a kind of open hearing to it in that kind of sense. But on the other hand, it would seem like foolishness, and what was especially foolishness is it seemed to make God one who now changes, who has passions, especially the idea of the crucifixion, probably even more than the incarnation, would sound, and the resurrection for that matter, would sound really strange, that God would dirty himself with the flesh and with sin and with death itself.
Let's take a break right there. When we come back, we'll pick up right there. Dr. James Buscher is our guest. We're talking about early Christians confessing Christ, early Christians as witnesses. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Gloria Christi Lutheran, Greeley, Colorado. St. John's Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Waltham, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. Zion Lutheran, Gravelton, Missouri. Christ the King Lutheran, Billings, Montana. Redeemer Lutheran, Nashville, Tennessee. And Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
The Faith, Once for All, Delivered to the Saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. James Buscher is our guest. He's Assistant Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored an article in the latest issue of For the Life of the World magazine titled, You Are Witnesses, confessing Christ crucified with the early Christians. It's Monday afternoon, May the 16th. I invite your questions or your comments as we come to you live. 1-877-623-6943-877-623-MYIE. You can send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. In the second hour of the program, we'll spend the entire second hour first talking with Dr. Bart Ehrman and having him answer the question, is the New Testament largely a forged document or set of documents? He says, yes. I want you to listen very carefully to our interview with Dr. Ehrman. He makes arguments that much of the New Testament is not written by those who we believe it was written by, or even by those that the documents claim they were written by. Then I want your response to what he has to say in the last 10 minutes of the program or so. 1-877-623-MYIE. Talkback@issuesetc.org or send us a tweet at issuesetc. In your article, Dr. Buescher, you make a distinction, and I think it's a very good one, between spectators and participants. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm trying to get across a little bit of the difference in how the early Christians in the ancient world kind of viewed the idea of seeing and what seeing involved. And it is a little bit of this notion of how seeing is this inherently for the ancient church a communion with that the one you are seeing. In other words, for us, I think a lot of times the very senses have been kind of redefined by the Enlightenment and certainly by the scientific method as just seeing for us as just an observation from afar. You know, there's a way in which what I look at has no impact upon my own self, my own being. It doesn't impact me at all. I just simply see the outward form, and it's kind of defined materialistically in that way. But for the ancients, when they, I think about seeing, a lot of times the imagery of light comes in. And so what they certainly believed in some sense was that the object does affect your inner being by the very fact that the light that comes from it enters into your eye and even enters into yourself. So part of seeing and the act of seeing means not just seeing the materialistic form of something, but actually to perceive the truth about it and the way in which that object relates to yourself. So I think even in Luke, Jesus talks about the eye being the light of the body. And if that eye is sound, your whole body is full of light. I mean, there you get a little sense of the light as the eye is the very way or the very window by which light enters the body. And so in some sense, to see Jesus is not just, of course, see his outward form. Many did that. Pharisees did that. Many unbelievers did that. Everybody did that in some sense that was around him. But the disciples saw in the way of faith, in the sense that they perceived the truth about him. They recognized him as the very image of the Father, as the very manifestation of God himself, and saw his glory, therefore. You know, the transfiguration, I think, even plays on that a little bit. Therefore, to see him, to see the truth about Jesus, requires something of you. It makes a demand upon you. It even changes your own identity. I mean, to recognize him as the Son of God is, in fact, that this has consequences for me. I need to lay down my life and follow. The very light of Christ now fills me, and I, too, am to follow and become kind of a... So that's the idea I'm a little bit trying to get across, and I think spectator and participant in our culture kind of expresses it in the sense that, if you're a spectator of a baseball game or, you know, you watch the Cardinals play or something like that, it has no consequence for my being. I mean, I can watch that game, and I'm not risking anything to watch it. But a participant, you know, he has to risk something, right? I mean, he has to take up a glove or a bat and get in the game, and he may make a fool of himself. He may make an error, you know, or the, you know, something like that. The participant, he risks something in this by being a participant, by following, by taking up the cross, that kind of aspect. So that's kind of what I'm trying to communicate there. And I think, you know, they certainly took that seriously. Therefore, to see Jesus is to be a witness. And that means that you yourself embody, in some sense, Christ. You witness to him in everything you are, everything you do, by the way you live, by simply who you are. And that's the idea.
Does that at least help explain why, as you point out in the article, the word that the New Testament uses for witnesses is the same word that we would use for martyrs?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, you know, fundamentally, I think that's how they kind of see the martyr and why they're going to call him a martyr. It's not just that he died for Christ, but that his death is, in fact, a witness. Is a testimony. And you can, I've looked at so many kind of different martyrdom accounts of the early martyrs. Almost all of them will picture the martyr in some sense as a manifestation of Christ crucified in some kind of way. That is to say, not that the martyr's death is salvific or something in the same way Jesus' death is, but rather that the death of the martyr preaches, it proclaims the significance of Jesus' death and his resurrection. So certainly Polycarp, the martyr of Polycarp, is maybe the easiest one to kind of see this. At the beginning it says, Polycarp showed us again a martyrdom in accord with the gospel, and then it shows you what it means by the fact that Polycarp goes through his own, in a sense, 3 days. The three-day passion of Jesus is mirrored a little bit in Polycarp. He gets arrested by a man named Herod, and he too is ridden into the city on a donkey. So you get a lot of kind of parallels, but it's not just parallels. It's the fact that in some sense Polycarp, as a member of Jesus' own body, is making manifest again, is preaching, is, you know, in a way, for the early Christians, an icon of Jesus' death and resurrection. And I think, you know, it is the very way Stephen is portrayed also in Acts, that he says the same things Jesus does. There's a lot of similarities, both especially between Luke 4 and Jesus' rejection in his hometown, for instance, and Stephen. Both are thrown out of the city. In both, the crowds get enraged. And, of course, Stephen prays the same types of things. Do not hold this sin against them. And then prays that his own spirit be commended into the hands of the Father. So, you know, it was just a kind of common way. I think, well, Paul's own preaching is the same kind of way in which he'll talk about being an imitator of Christ. You know, Jesus tells him in the call, I'll show him how much he must suffer for my name at the conversion of Paul. And then all of Paul's talk about dying for Christ and dying and being put to death to sin. That is the baptismal life. So, I think that's inherent in the martyr, is that he kind of proclaims Christ crucified.
We have only about 30 seconds here, Dr. Buescher. It sounds like the earliest Christians had a far more robust, expansive notion of themselves as witnesses. What would you add to our kind of anemic and emaciated view of that word today with about 30 seconds?
Yeah, in 30 seconds, that's a good one. Yeah, I think it is true. I do think we are coming into an age that is parallel to the pre-Constantinian age, where Christianity is becoming more and more a minority and paganism is on the rise. And I do think fundamentally for us, too often witnessing has just become a matter of PR campaign. It's just being put out kind of the facts or the message or something like that. And I think we do need to recover this notion of the importance of this embodying this life of Christ, of what it means to be a Christian and not just to speak like one or talk like one. And that, therefore, it involves an identity. It's just simply who we are and involves everything we are and do. And I do think we have to kind of recover that sense of discipleship in all that that means, especially before a pagan world that simply has little contact with Christ, little contact with the Scriptures, who I think also is looking for something real and looking for a real connection to God. And I think you can manifest that by and you have to manifest it, not just with words, like a sales pitch, but you have to manifest it with your life. You've got to back it up, and I think that's becomes even more important in the age that we live in.
Dr. James Buescher is Assistant Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, author of an article in the latest issue of For the Life of the World magazine titled, You Are Witnesses, Confessing Christ Crucified with the Early Christians. You'll find a link to this article under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Buescher, thank you very much for your time.
All right, thanks for having me.
When we come back, we're going to spend the better part of this second hour of the program on this Monday afternoon, May the 16th, talking with Dr. Bart Ehrman. He's author of Misquoting Jesus. He's now made famous some of his ideas about questioning the authenticity of the New Testament. His latest book is called Forged, Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. He says much of the New Testament has been forged. We'll see what you think also after our conversation with Dr. Bart Ehrman in the second hour of the program. Hour two of Issues Etc. coming up, our conversation with Dr. Bart Ehrman on whether or not much of the New Testament is forged, and then your response to that conversation in the last 10 minutes on this Monday afternoon.
Historic, authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.